Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It was called the Ghost Army, a deception unit launched toward the end of the Second World War. Its mission? To fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. And to do that, the Ghost Army employed all kinds of things. Inflatable tanks, sound effects, radio manipulation, phony convoys, phantom divisions, and make-believe headquarters. It saved thousands of lives and helped win the war, but their efforts were kept secret for about 50 years, until 1996, and were only recently officially recognized with the award of the Congressional Gold Medal. This hour, we'll learn about the vital role the Ghost Army played in World War II, and later in the hour, we'll speak with the son of an Iowan who was a member of the Ghost Army. Joining us for the hour, Rick Beyer. He's an author, filmmaker, also president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project. We'll hear about what that is a little bit later. Also co-author of the book, The Ghost Army of World War II, that was issued in 2015, a new edition out in 2023. Rick Beyer, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's so great to be here, Ben. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us, and I want to have our listeners get a taste of your documentary from 2013. Peter Coyote, a familiar voice on documentaries. He is the voice to have if you want to have a documentary. This is the start of the Ghost Army of World War II.
March 1945. After 9 months of bitter fighting, the Allies have driven the Germans across Europe to the Rhine River, the last natural barrier to the German heartland. It is here that Allied generals expect the battered remnants of Hitler's once proud army to mount their final defense of the fatherland.
Because the Germans had said the Rhine River is going to run red with American blood, and they meant it.
German reconnaissance planes take to the sky to pinpoint where the Allies will attack. Across the river from Dusseldorf, the view from the air reveals hundreds of American vehicles. Intercepted Allied radio transmissions confirm the presence of two American divisions. German observation posts hear them moving in across the river. All signs suggest the attack will come here. But the tanks spotted from the air are 93-pound inflatable dummies. The sounds come from loudspeakers. The radio transmissions from a script.
It's amazing the fakery that we were able to perpetrate upon the enemy.
That last voice from one of the original members of the Ghost Army. That's a documentary, The Ghost Army of World War II. Rick Beyer, the filmmaker there. For those just new to the Ghost Army, because it's a fairly recent bit of knowledge for World War II buffs, as far as that goes. Tell us more about this Ghost Army. When was it created, and where did this audacious idea come from?
Well, the Ghost Army was really created in late 1943, early 1944, and so they didn't have much time to put it together and train them and get them on the battlefields of Europe. But it was conceived of by two staff officers in England, Major Ralph Ingersoll and Colonel Billy Harris, and they were really totally different people. Ralph Ingersoll had been a civilian before the war. He was a left-wing celebrity journalist and author. Billy Harris was a kind of a button-down military guy. Everybody in his family was a general, and he became a general later. And the two of them working together, you know, looking to give the Allies every advantage that they could once they landed in Normandy, came up with this incredible idea. Well, let's create a deception unit that where 1,100 guys can pretend to be 15,000, 20,000, maybe as many as 30,000 people to fool the Germans about the location and size of American units.
Mm-hmm. And there are three main components here. You just referred to them, and we heard that in that clip, too. There's the visual component, the inflatable tanks, but not only tanks. It was inflatable everything out on the battlefield, the sonic, the sound version, and the radio version. Later in the hour, we'll talk with David Cantrell. He's the son of John Cantrell. He was in the radio aspect of this. But let's talk about I want to play another little clip from the Ghost Army, your documentary, and then you can explain perhaps a little bit about how this worked with inflatables.
If things went very well, there were air compressors. If things went not so well, there were bicycle pumps. And if things went terribly badly, there were our lungs.
In most cases, like a German tank, we could have it inflated and move within 15 or 20 minutes.
The artillery piece was good. The Jeep was good. But that M4 tank, that was the beauty. That was a piece of work. It really was.
All right, Rick Meyer, talk about the visuals here, because as you point out in your documentary, they didn't start with inflatables. They were sort of constructions out of wood, maybe wire, but then it turned out inflatables were the best to work with.
Well, and keep in mind that this is all happening so quickly, and everybody's trying to figure out what they're doing. And so when they form this unit, they don't have any inflatables. They don't even necessarily know that they want to have inflatables. They're building stuff themselves out of wood and canvas. The Army is testing different types of dummies, including a metal frame dummy with a painted canvas on it that you can mount on the Jeep, and it can be a mobile unit. But they eventually decide to go with inflatables, and they're made at rubber factories all across the U.S., especially the eastern half of the U.S., from, you know, Woonsocket, Rhode Island, to Columbus, Ohio, to Scranton, Pennsylvania. They're making these, and they're largely made by young women who are, you know, the people who are left to work in rubber factories with the guys off in Europe. And they have, as you alluded to, they have inflatable everything. They have inflatable tanks, trucks, jeeps, artillery of every size. They've even got inflatable spotter planes so they can, because any division would have a couple of spotter planes, so they would create fake airfields. And this is all to fool German aerial reconnaissance so that you can make it seem like a division is moving up to the line when in fact it's just a few people.
Mm-hmm. And we have to get our mindset back in World War II, not in, you know, we're watching, you know, the greatest European land war, largest since World War II going on in Ukraine, but with all kinds of drones and surveillance. We didn't have that degree of surveillance there. So while it's not Gettysburg, it's not the modern times either, knowing what your enemy is doing.
And yet, Ben, if I can jump in, there are numerous stories about the use of inflatables by Ukraine on the battlefield today.
Really?
And so they are equipped with radar transponders. They're equipped with heat generators. So they generate a heat signal. They generate a radar signal. They're inflatable. They've got inflatable rocket launchers, inflatable tanks. And they're out there, and they're putting them out there to draw German fire. So here's this old idea, right? As you say, oh well, couldn't work today, and yet they've given the old dog some new tricks,
right? And it tells us, if it's being used today, Rick, it tells us why it was kept secret for so long, right? Fill us in there.
Yes, the Army at the end of World War II kind of realized that this unit had worked, and they basically hushed it up. It wasn't perfect. There were some news stories about it popped up here and there, but they kept it secret until 1996. And I think the reason is obvious. They thought that, hey, maybe we're going to be in a war against the Russians starting in 1946 or 47, and we want to keep this as something that that we can use, and we don't want to give away all the details. And I, Ben, I still get people who say to me, well, maybe you shouldn't have revealed all this, Rick. And I'm like, I think the Army is okay with it. They certainly haven't voiced any objections.
Talk about the sonic aspect. The radio part we'll get to later when we have a direct familial connection to that.
Sure.
But how is that used? The trucks, and remember, this is before the era of tape to record audio on. We had wire recorders.
Right. So the idea here, if you back up, the idea is you have a fake story, right? We have a story that we're trying to convince the enemy of. Let's say it's the story that the 6th Armored Division is moving into the front near the Battle of Brest. So you're going to want to start with radio, which we'll talk about later. Then you want to have sounds. If you're doing this at night, you play these sounds out of 500-pound speakers mounted on the back of half track. You've taken the sounds that you need to mix from they basically made their own sound effects records in the US before they went to Europe. You take the sounds you want to mix, you mix them to a magnetized wire, which is, I know this is hard to imagine, but if people can whip their minds back to the tape recorder with a magnetized tape, this is a magnetized wire about the thickness of fishing line. Anyway, they would play these sound effects at night. It's usually sound effects of movement, tanks on the move, trucks on the move, men arriving at a location, digging in. They are trying to convey to that German listening post across the river or whoever's keeping an eye on them that something is happening there. So that, I mean, ideally in the morning, they send a reconnaissance plane over, and what do they see? They see tanks and trucks that are camouflaged and dug in, but they're inflatables. But now they've got the sound message, they've got the tank message, and we're going to have the radio message is going to be reinforcing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And this was, we have a break in less than a minute, this was how successful in some cases, in some pivotal moments?
Well, it was very successful, especially in their last operation, Operation Viersen, where they were impersonating the 30th and 79th Divisions, and where it probably saved thousands of lives. But it was successful in Brest, it was successful in Bettenberg, it was successful at other times. So it was a very valuable tool for the U.S. Army during World War II.
Rick Meyer is with us, author, filmmaker, president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project. When we return, we'll talk with Rick about that, because as amazing as this story is, we're only halfway through, because we want to hear how these members were honored very recently, and the part that the Ghost Army Legacy Project played in raising awareness about their vital role in the Second World War. The Ghost Army of World War II. We'll talk about it more when we return. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Back with more of River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer, discussing the Ghost Army. This was a World War II unit that was kept secret until 1996, awarded the Congressional Gold Medal in this year, in March, as a matter of fact, in 2024. We're talking with the documentary producer, author, and board member of the Ghost Army Legacy Project, Rick Meyer. A little bit later in the program, we'll hear how an Iowa student and his teacher are tied into raising awareness about the Ghost Army with an award-winning history website that was created for this. Rick, necessarily jumping over a lot of things, but tell us the story of the Ghost Army Legacy Project, when that started, and what its goals were.
Well, sure. Let me start by saying I first heard about the Ghost Army and started working on the documentary film 19 years ago. So it took 8 years to make the documentary. It's a couple of years to write the book. We're sitting around in 2014, late 2014, waiting for this book to come out in 2015. And I was thinking, you know, this unit was never honored the way it should have been. There had been some talk about them getting a presidential unit citation. Never happened, I think, because of secrecy. And I took it, I kind of got this notion in my head that they should be honored. And so we formed an organization, the Ghost Army Legacy Project, and our mission was to preserve and honor the legacy of this unit. And we did a bunch of things. We worked with students like Caleb, who you're going to have on shortly, on National History Day projects. We put up historical markers in Europe. We collected stuff for the archive. But we started to work on lobbying Congress for a congressional gold medal. And Ben, I have to tell you that every time I've undertaken something on the Ghost Army, I seem to repeat to myself the same line, how hard can it be? And it always turns out that all of these things are a lot harder than I thought they would be when we started. So it took us 7 years to get that legislation passed through Congress and get the president to sign the bill. And then another 2 years for the Mint to design this custom design medal and then to have the amazing ceremony that we had on March 21st at the Capitol.
Okay, let's hear a little bit from one remark. We'll have several audio clips from that. In March of 2024, in the U.S. Capitol ceremony, the 1,100 members received the Congressional Gold Medal. This is Congress's highest expression of national appreciation for distinguished achievements by individuals or institutions. And let's listen to House Speaker Mike Johnson giving his thanks to you, Rick Beyer, during this Congressional Gold Medal ceremony at Emancipation Hall at the U.S. Capitol. Let's listen to this clip.
He began working on this project 19 years ago, and he's been working on getting the gold medal for 9 years. Rick, you're about to hit your 20-year mark on this project, and it ought to come with a pension, my friend. It's taken a long, long time. In 2005, Rick was introduced to a woman who was the niece of a member of the Ghost Army, and her story sparked his interest and launched him on this journey of telling the stories of these brave men. And because of Rick, the Ghost Army has been recognized with websites and documentaries and books and museum exhibits and multiple monuments in Europe, and now, finally, with the Congressional Gold Medal. On behalf of everyone here, thank you for all that you've done to honor these men and their families. Rick, we owe you a great debt of gratitude.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson, I have to ask you, Rick, describe the feeling. What do you remember most about that ceremony? It had to be incredible.
Oh, it was incredible. There were 600 people there. We had the military leadership, the congressional leadership. I was surprised by Mike Johnson's remarks about me and very grateful for that. The thing that I really remember is when we were in the holding room right before we came out for the ceremony, there were three Ghost Army veterans who were there, 100 years old each, and they're sitting in chairs. And kneeling down in front of them, there are three people talking to each of the Ghost Army veterans. And the three people who are literally kneeling on the floor are the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Charles Brown. That's the highest ranking military officer in the nation, the Secretary of the Army, Christine Wormuth, and the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army, General Randy George. And I was speechless. And I mean, I'm tearing up a little bit now thinking about it.
Me too.
You know, because these guys, not they weren't simply talking to them. They were on their knees. They were face to face with these veterans. They wanted to connect with them. And that, I think, spoke a lot about the power of what the Ghost Army did in World War II and about the way that it's perceived by the U.S. military today. Oh. But it was an amazing, incredible ceremony. And to hear Mike Johnson and Mitch McConnell, Ed Markey and Representative Custer and Hakeem Jeffries and all these people talking about this unit that I have been talking about for 19 years was stunning. Mm.
Well, you mentioned Caleb Sinwell just a moment ago. So let me have you kind of dovetail your story into his. How does he enter the picture? And then we'll talk with Caleb and his teacher, Susan Turner.
Yeah, Caleb emailed me, I guess. I'm thinking now it must have been 4 or 5 years ago. And he was working on a National History Day project for the Ghost Army, and he wanted to interview me. And he did, and then his project won the state prize in Iowa, and I said to him at that point, as he was gearing up for the nationals, I said, "How'd you like to kind of lobby with us?" And and helped lobby for the gold medal. And I think Caleb was 14, and he jumped into that. And man, he was an incredible lobbyist. I'll let him talk about it a little bit, but he got some very big name people to sign on to this bill. And he really, even though he only lobbied for the last year or less of the gold medal effort, he made a big difference. And so, and then, of course, his History Day project went on to do quite well at the Nationals. But I don't want to take away everything might say to you.
Waiting in the wings, let's usher him onto the radio stage, so to speak. Caleb Sinwell, welcome to our program. You were a junior at Nashua Plainfield Junior and Senior High School. Welcome.
Hello, guys. Nice to be here.
Yeah, that's in North Iowa. Also with us, Susan Turner, a talented and gifted teacher there, plays a role here. Susan, welcome to you.
Thank you for having us.
And we have to throw in here that you were the Iowa History Teacher of the Year in 2022. You've won National History Day Teacher of the Year Award. So, wow, that's really great to have you with us as well. Caleb, pick this up. This was a website project. What in particular ignited your passion to do the hours and hours of work and then the lobbying for the Ghost Army project?
Well, thank you. That's a really good question. And I feel it's a simple answer. I grew up on a hog farm in Iowa, which makes sense, you know, being from Iowa. And while growing up and working on that farm with my grandparents, my grandpa would always tell me his stories of his service out in Vietnam. And I always found his service and the things he did over there very fascinating. And I always thought he was very brave for what he did, and I began to thank veterans from no matter what war they were in, World War One, World War Two, and others like that in Walmart, other things that whenever I'd see them, I'd always thank them for their service. And I actually, as I began to look more into our history of my grandpa and my great-grandpa and all that stuff, I found out that we have a long line of military history in our family. On my dad's side, we got ties from the Revolutionary War and the Civil War. And then on my mom's side, with the side that I farm, the hog farm with, we got my great-great-grandpa who was in World War One and my great-grandpa in World War Two, and then my grandpa that is still living and I farm with today who is from Vietnam. So I got a long line of military history in my family and a lot of interest and gumption to serve and thank those that sacrifice for us and our nation. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Caleb, when you set out on this project and now that you're looking back, what were the most challenging aspects for you in researching it?
Right. That's a good question. So like Rick Beyer said, it was a top secret unit. So there wasn't a whole lot published on it. You know, most of the knowledge I got was from Rick Beyer and his interviews with the Ghost Army veterans and that sort of stuff. So I would say the hardest thing about researching was finding the sources and actually researching to get all the information that I needed to build my website.
Mm-hmm. Susan Turner, there as a talented and gifted teacher at Nashua Plainfield Junior and Senior High School. Tell us about your role here and how you recognized Caleb's idea was really something that should have national prominence.
Well, I think I first met Caleb when he was in seventh grade. I pushed into a classroom and worked with all the seventh graders on National History Day, and he had done a project the year before on the Iowa hog lift, and he just got really impassioned about it. It was something he cared about, and I knew the next year he wanted to do one right away, and he wanted a military topic for many of the reasons that he mentioned. So, you know, I think my job is to support kids, and he's been a really easy kid to support because he's all in once he gets going on a project. And, you know, he just doesn't tire of it because he's been so passionate about the topics that he's had. And I think with the Ghost Army, he really didn't know anything at the beginning. And the more he learned, the more interested he was. And I think one of the things that's really evident when you meet Caleb is his enthusiasm. And I'm pretty sure that that's what Rick recognized when he invited Caleb to become part of the Ghost Army, lobbying group. And it was during COVID. So, you know, we were doing a lot of this stuff, you know, by email and by Zoom, and we're in rural Iowa, so it worked out pretty well. Many more people were willing to talk to Caleb than might have been, you know, pre-COVID. So COVID actually worked to our advantage. Mm-hmm. And once Rick invited Caleb to lobby, it, you know, the rest is history. I mean, he just dove in every day. He was calling, he was emailing, you know, he was getting, I think his first co-sponsor was Cindy Hyde-Smith from Mississippi. And then he got to work on the Iowa folks. And once he got to Chuck Grassley, things really started to happen. So, I mean, Rick had done all that groundwork and with all the other people, but it just seemed like it just needed to get, you know, a little extra boost. And I think Caleb played a role in that. And so it was very mm-hmm. exciting.
Caleb, what stands out for you in that lobbying work with Senator Grassley or others, conversations you had with them? Was it an easy sell? What were the hurdles there?
Well, a lot of the challenges I faced when calling and emailing senators from other states was that they always said that since I was from another state, that they tried to focus on the issues that were from their state. Mm-hmm. So when I was calling, for example, Nebraska or somebody like that, when I was calling them to let them know about what was going on and see if we could get their help, they'd always tell me that since I was from Iowa, that they wouldn't relay the message to them that they found it wasn't really important since I was from another state, which I always found was kind of dumb, honestly, because they had veterans and people from their state that were in the Ghost Army and that kind of stuff. It wasn't just my state. I was just relaying the message. That was probably the biggest thing, the biggest challenge I had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I jump in, Ben?
Sure, Rick.
This is Rick. I remember though when Caleb, I remember Caleb's frustration at this and how irritated he was about it. But then I also remember how excited he was when Chuck Grassley's office said, "Hey, you've been talking to us, and Senator Grassley wants to talk to you." And they set up, I guess, a phone conversation. And Caleb was, I think, pretty shocked to realize that by the end of this phone conversation, Chuck Grassley was on board as a co-sponsor. And then Caleb can tell you kind of what that led to, because Chuck Grassley came to his school. Caleb, pick up that story.
Please.
Yeah, of course. So one afternoon I was at the hog farm and I got a call from Chuck Grassley. And so I was sitting there talking to him. And the first thing that he said was that he was co-signing the bill that I was lobbying for. And that was really, you know, really happy, exciting moment. And we had a good conversation after that, which then leading to him coming to my school. I got to become good friends with him afterwards. And with him coming to my school, I got awarded by the Army recognition. They noticed me and that kind of stuff. And I got a certificate of achievement for being recognized and all the help that I've done with Rick Beyer and everything for the Ghost Army. So they had a Sergeant Major Holzman was his name. He came to my school and he presented this award to me. We had an assembly for it. He spoke and I spoke there, and Chuck Grassley spoke about what was going on with the lobbying and all that stuff. And I got awarded a big award by the United States Army, which was amazing. And I got to see Chuck Grassley and a whole bunch of other amazing people that got to come visit me and were there for me. Yeah. And yeah, it was a really, really good experience.
And then Grassley says in his speech at this visit, I'm sorry, Caleb, this is just too good for me not to tell.
Right, you're good.
He says, "Well, I'm going to go back to Washington. I'm going to get some other people to sign on." and he did. I think he got, did you count how many other senators he got to sign on? Three or four?
I did not, but he got quite a bit. He got everybody that we needed.
He was talking to him on the floor about it. I mean, he was gung-ho for sure.
And Caleb, you were at the medal ceremony as well.
Yes, I was.
What stands out in your memory? What will you hold dear forever?
I was really happy with everything. It was I can't possibly pick out one thing that was my favorite other than them finally getting the recognition and all the work leading up to everything finally getting passed and everybody getting what they deserved. But I think the best thing was them getting their medals, and I think that was probably the biggest thing I will take away was seeing their faces when they got presented the medals that they've been trying to work for a while, for all this time, and they finally got to get it.
Yeah, and Caleb, many of the members of the Ghost Army died before they could be recognized. That makes it extra meaningful for those who survived, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. Like Rick Beyer said, that we were really rushing with trying to get this bill passed because soon our Ghost Army will be an army of ghosts. I believe that's what he said. Mm. And that was really meaningful, you know, thinking about all the people that will never live to see the recognition that they deserved, will never get to be rewarded with the things that they rightfully deserved and that kind of stuff. That was a big heavy hitter, which is why I really tried to help and emailed and called every single day to get senators to co-sign.
Well, Caleb Sinwell, thank you very much for sharing your story. Well-deserved praise, a junior at Nashua Plainfield Junior Senior High School. Susan Turner, thank you for joining us as well, a talented and gifted teacher there. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yep.
When we'll come back, we'll talk with one of the sons of one of the members of the Ghost Army, David Cantrell, and we'll talk about that radio deception that was part of this sort of triad that Rick Beyer described when we return. And Rick Beyer will stay with us for the rest of the hour as we explore this amazing deception unit launched toward the end of the Second World War, its mission to fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe. Quite a remarkable story, finally recognized in 2024, in March. Back with Rick Beyer, author and filmmaker. When we return, it's River to River from IPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Back with more River to River from IPR News, I'm Ben Kiefer. They used inflatable tanks, sound effects, radio manipulation, phantom divisions with make-believe headquarters. The Ghost Army, a deception unit launched toward the end of the Second World War, its mission to fool the Germans on the battlefields of Europe, which it did in many cases, and it saved thousands of lives, helped win the war. Their efforts kept secret for 50 years until 1996, and only within the last, only recently officially recognized with the Congressional Gold Medal, these 1,100 members of the so-called Ghost Army. Rick Beyer is with us, author, filmmaker, president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project. We want to get into the radio aspect of this, Rick, and meet the son of one of those radio operators. But I wanted to play a little clip from your documentary film here that talked about this. This is we had the sonic arm, the inflatable tanks. Author and historian Jonathan Gown in your film said that the British had captured a Nazi radio interception unit. They were stunned at how the Nazis could pinpoint Allied units from their radio transmissions. And the Ghost Army radio operators used this knowledge to deceive them, as shared in this clip from the documentary.
It's an art of knowing just how many and what type of messages to send. And this is one of the things that the 23rd did, was it studied its own army's transmissions. So they knew if they were simulating an infantry regiment moving across an area, how many times a day would the regiments send messages to battalion? Would battalion send messages to regiments?
Wow, that's amazing, Rick. The degree of sophistication here. Explain that more.
Well, they wanted to, you know, deception is in the details, right? Because if you think about, let's think about inflatable tanks for a second. If you have a bunch of inflatable tanks in a field, does it look realistic? Well, not unless you've used a bulldozer to make tank tracks out to each of them. And if you have one tank that's missing a tank track, that could be a clue to the enemy that something is not as it seems. So similarly in the radio transmissions, they have to get every detail right. And one of the things in radio that's pretty amazing is that the German radio intelligence was so sophisticated that they could identify individual American radio operators by what's called their fist, their sending style, speed, rhythm, where they made mistakes. So the Ghost Army radio operators, this is sending Morse code. That's what I'm talking about. You know, the dots and dashes. Mm-hmm. The Ghost Army radio operators had to mimic the sending style of the radio operators that they're impersonating. Well, to start with, that does mean that the Ghost Army operators have to be able to send as fast or faster than anybody else in the theater. And they have to be able to learn to mimic them to create the realism that will convince the Germans, because one thing just a little bit off could unravel your entire deception.
Rick Beyer, author and filmmaker, president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project. Rick, let's invite David Cantrell on to join us for this final portion of the program. David, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I understand you're an Iowa native. You're the son of John Cantrell, an Iowan who served in the Ghost Army in its radio section. Your father passed away in 1990, I understand. What did your father tell you about his war activity when you were growing up?
You know, he wouldn't speak about it a lot. You know, as kids, of course, we were very interested in it. You know, we grew up with combat TV series and Rat Patrol and 12 O'Clock High, all those TV shows, and we knew Dad was in the Army, so we were very interested in it. But when we would ask him about it, he would just simply say that he was told not to talk about it, and he would be very vague and just not give a lot of details. We could get a couple stories out of him, but mostly it was just that he was a radio operator. He did say that they impersonated radio operators from other units, and it's interesting to me that Rick Beyer knows such details on all of this, especially the radio part, to include mimicking the individual operators and knowing their fist on how they actually send those dots and dashes, and that's what Dad studied as a high-speed manual operator, and then actually studying the operators from the different divisions and knowing how they, their own particular way of sending those messages.
Right, Rick, and expand on that, because in your book and in your documentary film, the U.S. Army went to find some of the best operators, radio operators, and John Cantrell, David's father, was one of those selected, right?
Yeah, so they started out by, there was a radio unit that they brought in, I think it was the 244th signal company, but they decided there was a bunch of people there who would have been involved. It was a signal company who would have been involved in cable transmissions, you know, wired transmissions that they didn't need. So they shipped those guys out, and they went out and they sought out many high-speed operators and medium-speed operators from other units to really have the best people in there. And my favorite story about this is from a veteran named Stanley Nance, who passed away a couple of years ago. But he was out in with his unit, different unit, out in desert maneuvers in California. And he said somebody in a Jeep pulled up and said, you know, you're supposed to come with me. And he says, well, where are we going? And he says, all I can tell you is that I can't tell you anything and for you to shut up. And so we got on the Jeep, and that's how we got into the Ghost Army. But yeah, there were people from all over that were brought into this radio unit who had extraordinary skills.
Yeah, and there was just another humorous moment from your film. This goes back to the inflatable tanks here in France, and some native French people seeing some U.S. Army personnel moving. Two guys moving a tank. Tell that story.
Yeah, so they were setting up the tanks, inflatable tanks, pretty early on in their time in Europe, and they would put up a security perimeter, but somehow a couple of Frenchmen on bicycles blundered through, and they're seeing these GIs working with this lifting this what looks like a 40-ton tank and turning it around, and they say to the guard who's on duty, whose name is Arthur Shilstone, who told me the story, they say, well, you know what, they're like, what's going on? And Shilston just finally says, oh, the Americans are very strong. and he shoos them out of there. But again, and I focus on this over and over, it's about attention to detail. If you don't get all the details right, if you aren't careful, you can unravel the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to you, David. How did you finally discover? You had some bits and pieces that your father kind of let through over the years when you were growing up. But how did you finally discover he had been part of the Ghost Army?
Well, it started after he passed in 1990, and cleaning out his radio room, a room that we had off the side of our living room that Dad had all of his radio equipment in. After he got out of the Army, he continued with his love of the radio. He got his civilian amateur radio license, and you could find my dad on that radio almost every evening up till the day he died. But in cleaning out that room, that office, found a box that we knew that he brought back from the war. It was a small wooden 12x6 box that he kept his military information in. And in looking at that, saw that when it said his organization, it simply said 23rd HQ letters SP and then TRS. Didn't know what that meant at all at that time. But it also just said for decorations, a good conduct medal and then a EAMTO medal. And some of the stories that we could get out of Dad was that he was involved in D-Day and also the Battle of the Bulge with Bastogne. And I thought, you know, if he's involved in those, he should have more than just this good conduct medal and whatever this other medal was. So that kind of got me started looking into it. I had a pretty solid dead end when I wrote the military records division asking for information on Dad's medals and what he did. And they told me that there was a large fire in all of the medical records back in 1973 and that they lost years of records of the soldiers. So I really didn't get anything until after things became declassified in 96 and then all the books started to come out and researching it through these books and the books stating 23rd Headquarters Special Troops writing it out and then Ghost Army and then going back into Dad's papers and looking at his separation papers and his discharge papers and finding out that they did spell out 23rd Headquarters Special Troops and they did mention that he worked in five countries doing tactical field transmission operations. And then, of course, also Rick Byers' book and his documentary was a huge help in that.
Yeah. I bet you, as David, as his son, you would have loved to have a final conversation with him about, now that it's all open, he couldn't tell you about it then, but certainly what changed your idea of who your father was in the war and the valuable role he played.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he was a very humble, quiet man. And to find out all of this stuff was just astonishing. There was a little hint on how good he really was in it. He kept a diary. And most of the entries in the diary were in boot camp, because once he got in the unit, he quit writing in the diary for the most part. But in the diary, he would put how each week he was being tested and how he was doing well in the testing and how fast he was with the sending the code and how that he was in the top of his class. And he was writing how he was astonished at how good he was at this and how he had taken it up. And so that kind of led me into understanding that right out of boot camp in this 13-week radio operation course, he was recruited directly into 23rd Headquarters Special Troops.
Mm-hmm. David, you were also at the Congressional Gold Medal Award ceremony at the Capitol. What do you take away from that? And there to honor your father, you were representing your family there. What do you remember most about that medal ceremony?
Well, the ceremony itself was just outstanding, overwhelming, and very humbling to see the people, even the place, you know, the Capitol and Emancipation Hall and the House Speaker and McConnell, and then the military guys, a lot of military guys, even sitting in the audience, as was mentioned before. And then the psych ops section of the military was there in great numbers, which would probably soak up the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops if they were in existence today. But just really overwhelming that they were recognized and what they did and how extraordinary it was. You know, I think Dad would say that he was just an ordinary guy, but he and his buddies did extraordinary things.
Yeah. Rick Beyer, we only have a couple minutes left. There's so many aspects we won't be able to touch on this hour, but I'm sure there are some aspects that you can bring out in the final minute or two that make this story even more real.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about when you asked me about the story about the inflatable tank and the two Frenchmen, there's a lot about the Ghost Army that is whimsical. You're working with inflatables. You're keeping secrets from fellow American soldiers. You know, you're doing stuff that seems diametrically opposite to what we think of as frontline soldiers doing. But at the same time, it's important to remember that three people were killed in action carrying out these deception missions. Several dozen people were wounded. And we don't even really know how many were wounded because there were people who were wounded who didn't get Purple Hearts. I know a few of those examples. But people bled and died to carry out these deception missions. And I think that's one of the reasons why I was so dedicated to making sure this unit was honored, that Mr. Cantrell and all the other people in the unit were honored for what they did, because they did risk their lives. It was a crazy, wacky mission, but they risked their lives to do it, and it worked. And I think that's a pretty amazing thing that people should remember.
Yeah. Rick Beyer, now that the congressional, these members of the Ghost Army have been recognized with a Congressional Gold Medal, and you've done 20 years of work leading up to that to raise awareness, also with the high school student there, Caleb Sinwell's contribution here. Where does it go from here? Or is that the end of the story that will be retold in different versions in the future?
Well, I kind of feel like I want to get back to Mike Johnson and say, where's my pension after 20 years? But I think that the Ghost Army story is never going to go away for me. I have a speaking engagement tonight. I'm leaving on Thursday to go do some stuff with the PSYOP troops at Fort Liberty. I have other stuff going on. And I think there's more historical markers we can do. There's more stuff going on. So I think we've done the big things. I think we've done the heavy lift, but I think I'm gonna keep on pursuing this story as long as my faculties remain intact to do so.
Mm-hmm. And Rick, are there big unanswered questions or about the Ghost Army?
Well, you know, we've talked all about the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops in Europe. There's another unit that was also honored as part of the Congressional Gold Medal. That's the 3133rd Signal Service Company that did two deceptions in Italy. I would love to dig into that story a little more. I know something about it, and I've met some family members, but I'd love to be able to dig into it, love to be able to go there and see where they carried out those deceptions, because I think there's a whole untold story having to do with that.
Rick Beyer, what a pleasure to have you on. Author, filmmaker, president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project. David Cantrell, thank you for joining us, I believe from Colorado today. Iowa native, son of John Cantrell, an Iowan who served in the Ghost Army. David and Rick, thank you so much for this conversation.
Great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Today's program produced by Samantha McIntosh with help and technical support from Danny Gear. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.